Yeah, like I butt heads with them all the time, but like what they would teach me on just like how to make controls feel snappy and how to make things pop and how to make things breathe and just all these weird skills. And and actually being now very sympathetic for what, like a lot of times I think we would all be resistant to what they're asking. And, you know, you quickly, once you start like running a studio, you're like.
Welcome to Game Dev Advice, the Game Developers Podcast. Your place for resources and in-depth conversations with other game development professionals. I'm your host, John J.P. Podlasic. I've worked at 10 different game companies, starting back in 1989 with the TurboGrafx-16. Over the decades, I've developed games like Mortal Kombat, Avengers Initiative, Beavis and Butthead, and numerous others. I now work for a startup called Level X. But this podcast isn't about me, it's about you, and the game development community. So if you have questions or ideas, give a call, 224-484-7733, or go to the gamedevadvice.com website. I have a great episode for you today, so let's kick things off with the new Game Dev Advice. Today's guest is Chip Sanini. He's been in the industry since 1994 and worked at a variety of game studios. Got a lot of interesting insights. I think you're going to enjoy it. Here we go.
Hey, John.
Cool. Thanks for being on the show. So what's your current role at Phosphor?
I'm directing a project, a dream project, actually, of something I've been pushing for 20 years. I do on that project right now, I'm literally wearing a lot of hats. I'm the project lead. I'm the art director. I'm the lead designer. Lead environment artist, the AI designer. I do a lot of stuff on it.
Wow. 20 years. Tell me about that. So there was like a design went back that you've just been sitting on and just wanting to make it for something or?
Yeah, exactly. There was, you know, it's from 1999, literally 20 years ago, that it was after playing a lot of like the early N64, Sega Saturn, PlayStation 1 games that I really liked what they were doing with like things like Zelda and Panzer Dragoon Saga and all those kind of early, you know, the 32-bit first 3D games. And it's been in the back of my mind forever. And I've always kind of had it there as like something I wanted to do. And we finally met a great publisher that wanted to do it. So it was kind of one of those things like, you know, we threw the pitch out there and we did work on it enough to have like mock-ups and actually working in Unreal 4. Right. And they liked it and it's being made. Yeah.
Wow. That's gotta be exciting to see dusting it off and being able to bring it to life and be involved with it like that. That's great. All right. So to kind of tell me how you got started in the video game industry.
Yeah. So I started the game industry in 1994. I was at the School of the Art Institute in Chicago, and Viacom New Media came to one of those career days, and you know they looked at my portfolio. They saw I wanted to make games. There wasn't a lot of people at their institute who were focused on something like games in the time. You know,
1994.
It was still I was doing 3D renders and render work when even like what was happening at Viacom was mostly the more 16-bit. Sprite art and things like that, although there was a lot of the CD-ROM stuff as well. But yeah, I had this like soft image experience, and I think the studio was moving towards like soft image and some 3D things. So they offered me an internship, and then I remember I got a call, and it was like, hey, you know, the internship is going to be taking a lot longer, and it wasn't a paid internship, but you know, if you want to make money now, you could help us with QA. So then lo and behold, you know, I was hired into the QA group where, you know, I worked with you. So I always think it's funny that, like, and this is just like a game biz thing where it's like, I think like at so many times, I think it's been like more than once, like we flipped roles over who is like on a hierarchy chain a little higher. And I think like, once you've been around long enough, you're like, yeah, it all doesn't matter. Like every intern's going to be in charge of you, you know, whatever. Right, like, it doesn't at any point, you know, anything like that's going to happen.
Right.
So it's like, yeah, I think we flip flop all the time, though. Like, I never know, like, in which project, like, one of us will be the client and which one of us will be, you know, the actual service.
I think you came in, you took the, it was probably the Zoop
Zoop QA test, right? Like, here's this buggy game. Let's see if you can find some bugs and how well you write them up, right?
Yeah. I mean, the really exciting thing for me about the whole QA experience was that I got my name, you know, burned into a ROM, which was like a goal since I was a little kid that like my name's in a, you know, 16-bit. It's in Beavis and Butthead. I think both the versions. Mm-hmm. It's in the Guts version.
Yeah, right.
And then, so it was like, it just felt so permanent, you know, like even today, right. I don't really care if my name's in any game we work on. Like, I mean, I've worked on in the last 10 years. I mean, I think it's like almost 20 products at this point. And like, I don't half the time, like, I don't know if my name's in it or not. I think when apps kind of became so, there's so many games and so many digital things, I don't really pay attention to the credits, even on things I've had way more input and have been way more proud to like, to, you know, I created this, but yet like my name in the credits of like Beavis and Butthead is like a big pride moment of like, yes, it's in a, you know, if somehow the world falls apart, right. It's still that EEPROMs might still, yeah, the EEPROMs might still work, you know, somehow they could pull it out of like a fossilized rock and figure out that, you know, while all this digital information is gone forever.
Fired up. So that was the SNES and Genesis stuff, right? That was back with Radical Entertainment and SNES developer. They weren't very good, but yeah.
Radical. How crazy is that? That like both games were done by different devs.
Yeah, it was crazy. That, like, and they were different quality and it was different designs. And it's not like, here's the game. We're just going to port it on all these platforms. It was, because the Game Gear version was done by NewFX that later became EA Chicago and all that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that was out in Hoffman Estates. So I'm not sure how that strategy went down, but it was basically like, here's a small amount of money because the Viacom lawyers were always, you know, hammer developers to get the price down. And they just went to all these different indie studios and like, do your version. And the Genesis one was great.
It's just insane to me they wouldn't know like that it wasn't just cheaper for one dev.
Right.
To just have a few, like instead of redoing all the art, all the sound effects, all the mechanics, all the systems, all the design, all the approvals. Even approvals. Think of that. Like that's a headache with MTV. I wasn't even thinking of that.
It is crazy to have like all these different versions of the same IP done by different developers with different content. And it's nuts.
What's funny is I remember at the time everyone saying, well, they're radically different systems, the SNES and the Genesis. And nowadays, like people are like, I can't tell the difference. I don't, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. The cartridges.
Because it was like, oh my God, Street Fighters are completely different. And it's like, they kind of look the same now. Like in hindsight, the Genesis version and the SNES version of Street Fighter. I know there's fans of both and I know there's very specifics, but come on, realistically. I mean, and even that's like, okay, well,
come on.
Beavis and Butthead. Like it was never pushing the systems to their knees. It wasn't one was faster and had a better, you know, hitboxes or whatever. You know, it's like, no.
Yeah. Right. It wasn't bleeding edge.
It had to just come out. I think that was the goal. Let it come out.
Right.
So someone will buy it.
Will it be out in October before Thanksgiving when 60% of the games are bought between Thanksgiving and Christmas back in the console days? I mean, or the console, the cartridge days. That's what it was. The Genesis one was inspiring and it had great music and they really put their heart and soul into it, but the SNES one was just a dud. But they had the book deal to do this strategy guides, and I just remember like, wow.
I remember when I started QA, one of the things that blew me away was I think it was Mike Casso found a bug in one of the Beavis and Butthead where I was not familiar, you know, that was just coming in. I hadn't made any games yet. And now it doesn't even sound that weird to me, but at the time I remember he, like there was some mode where right between it went from an attract mode to like a high score mode. If he like slammed on a certain button, the game would just crash. And I was like, how did you know to like press this button between, cause I'm just playing, like I'm just trying to whack on the buttons when I'm playing the game and nothing's really breaking. You know, that's not really how you break a game.
Yeah.
You know, they've already like figured out stuff for cues for inputs and things like that. But he just figured out like when there was like a whistle being played in between these two screens, it would cause a crash. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I was like, how did you figure that out? Because that just to me was like, you won. You found the coolest bug, you know, that you could just crash the game. And he's just like, that's just, you kind of learned to do that, you know? And I was like, wow, you know?
Yeah. So what do you wish you'd known when you started in the industry now that you've been in for 25 years?
I don't know. That's a good question. One thing I don't think I realized how jealous I would be of kids working in their basement. You know, that like, you know, Like that is something that, like, I think a lot of us now that just younger people just doing what they want to do, making their passion play, that they, you know, without having clients, without, you know, doing this as work for hire with just them or their friends, that they can, you know, just outcompete, you know, even AAA studios. You know, you look at things like Minecraft or even now, like, you know, not the Untitled Goose Game is that, but those kind of things where it's like, yeah, these passion plays are doing great, you know, Terraria or Stardew Valley or any of those things. It's like, and then you look at like giant AAA things like Anthem, you know, in the recent Ubisoft stuff where it's, you know, it doesn't latch and it's like, it's just hard to compete.
Right. You know, 25 years ago, if you didn't have a publisher, you didn't have a game, right? You know, there wasn't just kind of, you know, DIY and put it out there really. There wasn't really any real options like that. So you always had to find that publisher and sign the deal and make the game to have somebody that would front the money because it would cost, you know, millions of dollars to get cartridges made and end caps and deals with Jeffrey Dollars and Toys R Us and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. It's kind of crazy to think that like Doom may have been the one. Like, I mean, there's probably other anomalies too. And even like, it's funny that Bethesda came from that. I mean, not quite the same as Doom, like shareware, but that like Daggerfall, you know, was this like weird, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't an IP. Like I know they worked on Terminator and I didn't even work on like an NFL game or something. I think they did to get some money, but, and where Daggerfall was more like a passion play, but yeah, it is crazy to think that like, I mean, I just couldn't do it without, like, I wasn't a programmer. So I could, I, there was no tools for me. There was no Unreal Engine till I was already in the industry for a few years. And there was definitely no Unity. And even when Unreal came out, it wasn't like people could really just self make a game. There wasn't asset stores.
Yeah. It was expensive. Yeah. It was expensive as hell. Right. I mean, yeah. It wasn't just download it for free and learn it. Yeah. I mean, companies used to write their own engines and they would have tools and tech teams and, you know, it was all, there was no real turnkey type scenarios with engines and stuff like there are now. So yeah, it's
just, yeah, now you just have the problem of
spend the money,
you know, discoverability, which is just the like so many amazing products that nobody's looking at, you know, and it's like such a weird thing of how you, it's not about like capturing lightning in a bottle like a great game, it's like capturing lightning in a bottle in people's minds, like do they notice your thing even exists?
Yeah The barrier of entries are so low that there's flooded you know, in terms of games out in the market. So it's like, how do you get people's attention and how do you compete with, you know, user acquisition? And a lot of these companies spend millions and millions on user acquisition, and how do you go head to head with them unless you find some way to get, you know, guerrilla marketing or get people to play to PAX and get some kind of buzz going or some kind of way to get something going.
I mean this isn't really what I wish I knew, but I wished I would have went on social media way sooner. It feels like I feel like, you know, when you were a certain age, there was like, there was so many different, you know, there was like Friendster and then there was MySpace and then there was Facebook and you weren't sure what things were going to latch. And I naturally was repelled by all those. I was like, you know, I don't want to waste time on that. I have, you know, I'm happy with my life. I have friends. I was married. I didn't really need somewhere to just kind of post things, but I feel like then, like when Twitter did originally come out, it seems like the people that got on Twitter early really did like make a career out of it. And they, you know, those people, like when people were early on getting lots of followers, I don't feel like that ever replicated again later, you know, that like a nobody could just kind of get followers the same way. Like now, you know, if somebody shows up on Twitter now, they're usually famous if they just started, you know, or something, they've already done something big. So they're already getting followers, but
like Jennifer Aniston going on Instagram.
It's not like she proved like you could do that. It's like, no, she just proved Jennifer Aniston can do that.
Right.
You know? Yeah. Like, I don't think anybody now just shows up on Twitter and all of a sudden amasses 200,000 followers just because they're witty or interesting, you know, like they had, you know, up to this, which people did originally now, you know?
So kind of back to that idea, like what kind of advice would you give someone looking to get their first job today? Like just knowing what the landscape is and how things have changed.
What's really interesting too there is like how much the industry is different and so many just different like eras, like the different era of when I entered, when it was basically like, oh my God, you know, a 3D program, we have to hire you. you know, and then someone I've worked with for more than 20 years that they just liked, I mean, Jared Prano, where they, you know, he didn't have a lot of experience at anything, and they just kind of liked his ideas, and they liked, I think he did an art test or something, I don't remember, but it was like, hey, that's cool. You know, like nowadays, like we really look at portfolios very carefully, and like, what did they do? Had they done, you know, how do they, do they have like a specialized field or not? Or do we, for programming, tests. We give them programming tests. I mean, one thing that's, I think, really different now is though, the game industry is almost becoming so different in terms of like it's, it used to be kind of like, I think in the early 2000s that almost all the AAA studios were kind of similar in their requirements, you know, between like a Midway and a THQ and early Rockstar Games and early EA Sports and those kind of things. Like everyone was kind of looking for the same skills, where now I think there's a difference between like a mid-tier indie studio, what we look for, versus what a AAA studio would look for. And I think like in a AAA, they're really looking for a distinct specialization. Exactly. Like they're looking for like, hey, you know, are you a lighting expert, and what do you do for lighting? And we're far more likely to, while we still like tend to put people in big disciplines like environment or character on art or in programming, we look at gameplay versus engine. But I think like you're going to probably wear a lot more hats where in AAA, like you might be so hyper specialized, you know, and just doing one end. But yeah, in indie, we tend to, you know, you're probably going to work on multiple things that are a little bit outside your expertise. Not that we're going to, you know, judge you on how you don't do something well, but it's almost like a different even want. Like I've seen people that are unhappy with AAA, and I've seen people that are unhappy with indie. So it's even like knowing what you really want to do and then going out for it. Like some people want to be a very tiny part of something that, you know, 20 million people will play. And some people want to be a big part of something that, you know, might be a smaller audience, but that audience will really like it, and they'll have more control and more say over what it is. And I think I've seen both sides like be happy or sad about it. So it's almost like just even figuring out, you know, where you want to be and what you want to do.
Yeah, exactly. What's important to you? Like, is it like I want to be hyper specialized and just do, you know, character hair for this one series of games and just focus on hair tech and make it look the best, or be more generalized on a smaller game, but have more input with a smaller audience, but knowing that it's not just such a
and they're literally totally different mindsets. Like one mindset's almost more like a craftsman, you know, like you're like, you know, like almost like what carpentry is. Like I'm gonna do this, and maybe I'll do the same thing every day, but I like it. It's stable. I enjoy it. And the other thing might be. Yeah, the other thing is more like
I'm good at it.
I don't want to call it like art, but it's more like I don't know how to do this. I don't know if this is going to work. I'm not sure how this is going to go, but I like doing something new all the time and challenging myself. And they're very just kind of different mentalities and how you go into it. I mean, something that's funny, like at Phosphor Games, like we've yet to work on a sequel. Like we're always working on something new. And I actually do like that a lot. Right. Like I kind of feel like when we've been asked to just repeat ourselves, it's a little boring. It's almost like, why would we do that? Like, why would you just make this? Yeah, like we already did that. So why would we go backwards and just do it again? But I'm also getting to the point too where I'm like, wow, it'd be nice not to be so challenged all the time and always have this like rock to push uphill. Like it would be nice to have some type of like wheels to lift the rock up and some kind of, you know, machine. So yeah.
Right. Yeah, and in terms of diving a little deeper, just in terms of like art and design, like what are your thoughts about that on advice?
Yeah, and that even further goes to the indie AAA, where you know some people, I think if you want to be like a project leader, director, or doing something bigger in design, like it's really hard now. I think in AAA, you might not even see your lead designer; they might not even know what you did.
Right.
You know, if it's a big enough team,
same continent. Yeah.
Yeah. You're right. Exactly. You might not be on the same continent. So that all goes back to like how much say do you want to have in the product and picking the right product for yourself. But yeah, in terms of like very specifics, it's like, it's funny. We use both Unreal and Unity a lot and they're great. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think Unreal is really good for a team, you know, if a team's coming together, a larger size team on with that's more of a traditional game, you know, with either level design or certain kind of mechanics. I think Unreal is amazing for that. I do think Unity is really great for smaller and app-like experiences and non-traditional games. Like Unity is actually really good at like just the way it can interface with every platform so well, like you know, doing native things an iPhone can do, or integrating with Facebook, or doing all these kind of like non-traditional games. So it's like I never really view one of them as being superior. It's really they're just different tools for different.
Yeah,
because like Unreal isn't as good at like really some simpler things like that, but Unity is really terrible at like level design and level, you know, and having any any kind of consistency. Right. Like the funny thing is Unity will often have like, well, if you go to the marketplace, there's literally 20 versions of blueprints, right? Yeah. There's like so many of them and they all do different things. But then you don't also have a common like hiring language. Like some person may have used Playmaker and then someone else may have some, you know, another tool. And it's like nobody's quite on the same page. And then neither of them are totally integrated into the engine the way you want. So it's like there's usually a solution, but it's not like a global, like every, you can't just point to like, you know, an expertise of having it and finding it useful. It's more just like if you need it for yourself on a smaller project, it's there. But
yeah. And we've had, I mean, we use Unity at Level X and we've had experience with, obviously there's challenges here and there, but it also works well with other platforms. Like we did some stuff on mobile and tablet. And then we had an engineer designer kind of go crazy for a bit and he figured out how to get it all running in VR on the Vive, and we did some up-resing and textures and did some stuff. And then we all of a sudden just, you know, had this kind of cool little sandbox experience that we developed on the Vive, which is, you know, a completely different platform than a phone or a tablet. So yeah, that kind of expandability on different platforms is kind of
cool. Yeah. It's kind of insane how good the tools are. I mean, Unreal's pretty good at that too, but yeah, like, you know, like I've seen people port over like games that they've already made in another engine, and they'll actually, like, you know, it's worth it to port it back to Unity to just make sure we can put it anywhere whenever something comes out that that we could just put it on there. We had a project that it was crazy. Unity had a really good Maya importer where this one project, I don't think it's public, so I can't say the name, but they made this whole game in a custom engine using Maya as like the level editor and all this stuff.
Okay.
And then they had all these scripts and we imported the Maya scenes wholesale perfectly. And all these scripts that had like all these animations and things, like we parsed them and ran them. So we basically emulated their engine in Unity and it worked. Like it was one of those things like the whole time you're like, yeah, this won't work. Never worked.
Yeah. Just get this out of the way. Prove and go on to the next thing. Like, holy shit.
Yeah. Like this sounds great on paper, but it won't happen. And then it's like, and it, I mean, it wasn't like easy, like everything was a thing, but it was like, eventually it did work where it's like, okay, this one custom engine now could technically work on any mobile device, any high-end console, any, you could put it in VR, you could put it in AR. Switch. You could literally put it on anything. And it was like, it was just kind of crazy that's, you know, like for any perf cost of a custom engine, it was crazy that just worked. So
No, it's crazy. So wow, you've worked on a ton of projects. So like one or two favorite games or projects you'd like to talk about, or like things that kind of stand out in your career in your mind?
Yeah, it's funny because there's, you know, there's just so many. And I was talking about the one working on right now, which is a crazy dream come true. Then I had a couple years ago, I worked on a game that was actually autobiographical.
Okay.
Where it was about, you know, it was a metaphor, but you know, it was a game, Corpse of Discovery, where you you were this like space explorer and you had to keep, basically you were chasing a dream. You would constantly had this thing, and once you'd kind of reach it, it would just kind of be over and you'd have to keep doing it again and again, and you'd keep, well, meanwhile your family was getting older and growing and you weren't around them at all, and it was very much like a kind of a work-life balance kind of like thing on that. And that, I think it got, you know, it's funny. It was one of those games. It had some weird connections now to like what Death Stranding is doing, where it wasn't really supposed to be enjoyable. Like it was a funny thing where it's like, if it was so enjoyable, then it would have been worth, you know, that would have kind of ruined the message. Like you were doing these things that were kind of supposed to be errands and kind of tedious and kind of like work. So like it was like we wanted to make it fun, but it also like, oh, if it's too fun, it kind of didn't work with the narrative, which was like funny. So we were, it was kind of in this weird spot. And I almost see Death Stranding having some of those similar, like the way it's like a quest and a job and you're kind of out. And there was actually a weird inky creatures attacking you the same way. and you were going over terrain, you know, vast terrain doing like work while this like holographic people are giving you missions and stuff. So it was like funny how similar it is, but that was like a big thing. And again, it didn't get great reviews. And I think it was like terrible on Steam, but I had one review from one site, like Killscreen, which which completely understood everything I was trying to do with it. They still gave me like a 69. And so I think they're like, it's great. We did all these cool things. It's kind of an interesting experience, 69. But I still like hold that up as like, I'm proud of that. More proud of that review than I think anything I've done.
Yeah, because it connected.
But yeah, and then, but then over the years, just like Midway, it was a crazy experience working with all these guys who, you know, worked on arcade games and, you know, all these games I played as a kid, like working with George Gomez.
Yeah, and, you
like,
and me both. Right.
And he would, you know, the fact he would bring in his Tron illustrations and you would be holding the piece of paper that would show the Tron joystick. And you're just like, I can't, I mean, this is the game I spent so much time playing.
Yeah.
And the guy that made it's right here. George, even what's funny is he even worked on like mask figures, which I was a little too old for, but my brother had, and I still liked playing with them. Where it was this toy line of like these cars that turned into like they had like guns on them and stuff. And I'm like, he just did so many things, and you're like, wow, I'm just like hanging out with this guy that's doing all this cool stuff. And then Mark and Sal, like both really legends, teaching me. Yeah, like I butt heads with them all the time, but like what they would teach me on just like how to make controls feel snappy and how to make things pop and how to make things breathe and just all these weird skills and and actually being now very sympathetic for what like a lot of times I think we would all be resistant to what they're asking. And you know, you quickly, once you start like running a studio, you're like, fuck, I'm Mark and Sal now. Tell all the kids to do something. Right. They're like, no, fuck you.
It doesn't make any sense. Why I gotta do that? And it's like, no, those guys knew what they were doing. Listen to me. Yeah. And I was wrong back then, but I'm giving you wisdom. So do it.
Right. Yeah. All right. 100%. Like I'm thinking like, God damn, I remember giving them some shit that like now I just laugh at.
Yeah.
I used to give Ed Boon, I don't know if I gave him that much crap about 60 frames a second, but I remember thinking like that's like when Gears of War first came out and it was looking gorgeous at 30 and GTA was 30 and everything was 30. And it's like, does it really need to be 60? And now like, you know, once you do VR, you're like nine, if it's not 90, it's too slow.
Right.
You know, it's
nauseous,
like,
it's, and you get dizzy.
Yeah. And all gamers are like loving 60 now. Like 60 is like 30 is quickly becoming like unacceptable. Mm-hmm. And 60 is becoming just like standard in almost every game now. And it's like funny to think of like, you know, like it bothered him way back then. And, you know, it took all the rest of us to catch up to it. But
right. Yeah. I remember being like, oh, the frame is not 60. I'm like, can't we just live with it at that? No, no. We got, I'm like, I'm like, we got to ship the GameCube. What are we going to do? How are we going to get running at 60?
Right.
You know, it was just such a technical hurdle, and it was so much work you had to get into it. But he knew that reaction time and that feel, you know, the stuff that the great designers like he and Sal and Mark and George knew that stuff. And
It was a totally great learning experience. Like it'd be hard to imagine not. Like I'm so grateful I was able to work with these people who understood that and had these, you know, formulas, and you know, you could sit with them. And I remember watching like Mark just like testing like just button inputs and how things would go and feel. And he's like, "Do you see that lag?" And I'd be like, "No." Right. And you're like, "No," but it's like and then, you know, eventually you would like, and then when something would happen, you would start noticing, like, "Oh fuck, that is right. You know, right. Like, what's wrong with it? You'd play the game one day and it's like, it's running at 30. And you're like, like the thing I was recommending that feels terrible. Yeah, okay.
Got it. And it's like, oh, wait a minute, that NBA Jam game's made like $2 billion. Okay. He gets that control thing.
Yeah.
What was the first game that you had a non-QA credit in, like for doing art? Was it Blitz or something before that?
It's funny because at Viacom, I worked on a bunch of things.
Oh, that's right. One of my
company. Oh, yeah. The first thing would have been a Beavis and Butt. Like, the funny thing is that Beavis
Virtual
and Butt
Stupidity.
Had Virtual Stupidity.
Yeah, which is a classic. Yeah, which is
right. Out. Yeah. Yeah, and then what's funny is I made it. You may have been the producer on those little MTV games that they extracted out of it.
I did the Wiener Takes All, the You Don't Know Jack ripoff Fired By. All right.
Yes.
It was Beavis and Butt-head Trivia. Okay. So yeah, okay. That was Baki worked on the little thingies and stuff where we made.
I did a little games. Thingies. Yeah. Okay. Little thingies was like, cause they took out, I had an ant mini game. So yeah. I cleaned that up and I may have made. Yes. Yeah. I had that, which was cool because for a while that was a free demo. So I could like put that on my website. It's like, look, I'm not pirating anything. And you could see one of my products. And that was, you know, before, you know, that was like when there was only like shitty Flash games. So it was like neat that someone could click on the EXE and it mostly worked. But then after that, I think it was Subterracore, which was,
Of course,
which was a big thing. Right. Yeah.
Big RPG.
Subterracore, you know, on the games I've worked on, like that was one of those most like bittersweet learning experiences where it was like a game I wanted to make forever. I loved Japanese style RPGs.
Mm-hmm.
The team was amazing.
Right. You know,
Elisa and everybody over there.
B-Man,
Yeah, and it was one of those learning experiences where you're like, it was like one of those first things where like the market slapped you in the face where I wasn't used to. I mean, I kept thinking like, if you make an amazing game that's really cool, you know, there'll be a giant audience and you'll be, you know, doing more of those and you'll be in the top of the world working on that kind of stuff. And it was one of those like, wow, like nobody showed up, you know, for it kind of thing.
Right.
And, you know, I think it was just, I hadn't really experienced that before, like that point, you know, like, I mean, because at Viacom, like this, like the Beavis and Butthead Virtual Stupidity, it didn't really sell that many, but I think Viacom was really proud of it. Like, I think it was like, I got a plaque for like 100,000 units.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right.
Which nowadays it's like, you know, that's nothing, you know, 100,000 isn't anything. But I remember like they clearly did something they weren't thinking it was going to do because that was a good number for them. And it seemed like it was received well enough and all that. But
yeah,
like I think like Subterra was my first thing where I was like, you know, really understanding like more of the industry of like, wow, you can still make something great that you put all your passion and time on and it
doesn't resonate,
it's going to get rewarded. You know, the market didn't say, make more of those.
So what are you curious about right now in the industry? I mean, because you're in the forefront there, you're working on different platforms, you're doing different stuff.
Okay, quick question break. What are your thoughts so far? Do you have a topic idea, a question to ask, or a guest suggestion? Let me know at 224-484-7733 or on the gamedevadvice.com website.
I think a couple things. Like, I think one thing is kind of like what you're talking about with all these services, just seeing where they go, like knowing that like all of them aren't going to succeed and seeing which ones do, which ones don't, why didn't they succeed? You know, the whole streaming thing is really intriguing. And, you know, it seems like, there's a lot of cool reasons why streaming could be really great. And there's a lot of things of like why it won't work. Mm-hmm. So I'm really interested in that. I tend to feel like I fall on the side of like I've heard of things like Steam might do it or something where you actually buy the game, but then you have an option to stream it, which would be like, well, that would be the best of both worlds, right? You'd own it. You could download it, but if you don't want to download it and you want to play it on the, you know, somewhere on your phone, you could actually stream it or something. So that would be, I don't know if that's actually happening, but that sounded like a cool idea of that.
Yeah.
But then, something that's always amazing to me in this industry is that there's always some dominant player. There's always somebody who's like totally dominant, unstoppable, and you can't even understand in your head how they'll ever be knocked off their perch. But then like every 3 years, it's like something else becomes the new dominant it game.
Right.
That came out of nowhere that you could have never predicted by a company you wouldn't have saw doing it. And I'm always like, you know, like it's always crazy to think that like, it always feels like, oh, we're done here. You know, this game took over.
Yeah.
And time to move on. But it's like, no, that always changes. Like every time, like nobody ever stays on the top forever with these games. And then something that you can never predict will be the next thing.
Right.
Like I never thought Dota and those things would have ever been big. Mm-hmm. And now I would have never thought they would have slowed down, you know?
Yeah, right. So, because like, well, now they're this big, they're just going to keep going. And
yeah. I mean, there was one point where it's like, oh my God, these are the biggest things ever. And everyone needs to have a Dota clone. But no one's going to topple Dota and League of Legends. And now like you just don't hear as much about them compared to things like Fortnite or, you know, what Call of Duty was. Or I remember just how giant Madden was, you know, that Madden was just this massive thing at one point.
Right.
I mean, and then you even go back further, like Street Fighter and things like that. And it's just like, it always seems like some game is going to be the biggest dominating game that, and it'll never stop dominating. But
yeah. Or even genres, right? Like there was a whole period, was it like the 90s, where it was the, you know, real-time strategy games, and you had Red Alert out there, and it was like, you know,
StarCraft
and all that. The joke was, you know, you couldn't swing a dead cat, you know, without somebody making an RTS, and then they just poof, just disappeared. Like, where did they go? You know, they just gone
completely.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's even crazy that, like, I mean, forever everyone's like, you know, people only play like first person shooters, and then well, Fortnite came out and changed that, you know, now people are fine with third person shooters, and you know, people only play hyper realistic, and now they're playing a cartoony game. It's like nothing. You can't predict why that's going to take over and why it's going to work.
Or first person games, you only play on a keyboard. You can't play it on a console. Yeah. Well, Halo comes out and like, okay, I'll play first person games with a controller now. And
yeah,
they just break the rules.
Yeah. And you even look at something like Halo, where it's like, I thought Halo was just the king of FPSs for a long time. I mean, that's all people were talking about. And now, I mean, the thing is, a lot of those games don't really, I mean, Halo is still super popular and people will play it, and they'll make a great amount of money on that, but it's not the same cultural thing when it was like number one in everyone's head.
Yeah.
And it's like Nintendo is fairly perennial with every Zelda and Mario that they're going to go to the top, but they're not like, it's not like everyone every night is just playing Zelda right now, you know, the same way they're playing Fortnite or something.
Right. Yeah. 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 Halo was just so huge. I mean, I had buddy Chris Nicolella on the show, and he was talking about, you know, the movie that was being worked on.
Right.
You know,
they were Peter Jackson one.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. They were making the movie, and he was working on the toys, and the movie fell apart and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, you just think of how big those things are. And then they're still a marquee type brand, but they're not that cultural phenomenon they were when they were. So everyone would be playing it, you know. And Grand Theft Auto was that way too. I just remember you'd be like, oh, you got to get your game up for GTA because it just sucks all the oxygen out of the room. And there's no one's playing anything else because everyone just jumps on GTA.
Although GTA is still insane, where it's like, every time I see like a Take-Two report, they're like, yeah, we still made, you know, $100 million from GTA 5. And you're like, how the fuck did you? Yeah, that came out 5 years ago, or 6 years. Right. How are you still making $100 million? Or it's probably more than that. It's probably like half a billion or something.
Yeah, yeah, some
insane
crazy
number. I can't fathom.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, who is giving you money that hasn't given you money yet?
Yeah. It's like, if you're going to play, now, is it third world markets? Where does it go?
I mean, I know like that. It's one of those funny things where I think like the online version is now making so much money, and the online version, the way I've heard it was an afterthought, you know, by like more like not the, you know, the really heads of that drive it, but more like someone else. And it's now been like the main way it's making money, which is funny.
Right.
But yeah, I think what's interesting in the industry now is like going to see like how, I feel like all these passion plays and weird left field things are the things that are kind of dominating, you know, things like Fortnite, the way Dota kind of came from nowhere, the way League of Legends came from nowhere, that the way Warframe came out of nowhere, that I see like the AAA studios like EA and Activision and Ubisoft all a bit trying to figure out like, well, how do you replicate that?
Yeah. How can you tap into that? And how can we make some of that? Yeah.
Yeah. Because all these things were done at a lower scale. Like, I mean, I know like, you know, the way Fortnite was turned into Battle Royale was not the same scale of turning, you know, making Anthem or, you know, doing
a PUBG. Yeah. Right? I mean, PUBG was using perfect asset stores, right?
You know. Yeah. Totally. Yeah. People are all recognizing it as that. And and it was just using like, I mean, some of the limitations were just because that's the way UE4 did it out of the box, you know, originally. And it's like interesting to see of like, how can these AAA studios replicate that, or can't they replicate it, you know? And then it really feels too like even the you know, I don't know how closely you're following Death Stranding right now, but
not too much, unfortunately.
But like, just it's, even though the critics kind of ripped it, it's really blowing up in terms of like, it's all over my Twitter feeds, it's all over all the, you know, blogs I read, it's all over, you know, a lot of people I just anecdotally know are playing it, you know. They're all like saying, yeah, it's not, you know, once you have these expectations are tempered, it's good for what it is. And that's such a weird, strange game And I think almost the interest in it, whether you're buying it or whether you're just reading about it or whether you're watching videos, that it's showing like, well, it's something new, right? It's something different than you've, it's not just another shooter version or something that you've done. It's basically an indie game done at the most highest AAA level.
Yeah.
That, you know, that it's like exciting to people and they're talking. I think like at first I was like, when it was getting kind of mixed reviews, I was like, oh, does Sony really regret they put so much into that? But now it's just been dominating a lot of the mind share that I'm like, oh, they must view this as a victory. You know, the fact that everyone's talking about it and it's only on a PlayStation 4 right now.
Right, right. Which is key for them, right?
It's like, yeah, like that must be a win.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone's comparing the PS4 Pro to the PS4, you know, and stuff like that. So it's like, I wonder if like our, I don't know how you incubate that though into like a giant publisher. Like, how do you, you know, do you hire somebody and just let them go crazy? Like, that's what happened there. Like, they just let Kojima do what Kojima does. I mean, I don't know if a AAA studio could justify, like, yeah, we made that and no one showed up.
Right, you know?
It was like $100 million play and like one person's vision and nobody cared. Like, I don't know how you do that. So it's like a really interesting space to be in. Like, you obviously you see big famous IPs can just, you know, things like Madden, things like Mortal Kombat, those things can just kind of keep going and just be bigger, better, more. But I mean, in terms of the things that, you know, if you want to, if your goal is really to replicate like a Fortnite success, like how you would do that seems, you know, really like, I have no clue. Like, I would have no advice to EA or Activision or like, there's no, like, you know, armchair quarterback on, well, you should,
You know, just do this. They get it all done. Well, especially too, because they have all that structure and they have all their, you know,
shareholders,
but you know, the gates and the green lights and all the processes where they'll be like, I don't get it. Shut it down. You know, so it would never see the light of day. And shareholders, I mean, wow. You know, Ubisoft was just hammered a week or two ago where they were saying how much they missed their earnings by like $1 billion. Like, we missed.
What's crazy is that they were following their formula that had worked so long, and then people just like, I'm done with formula kind of thing.
Yeah. You
know, I mean,
right.
There were some other things where I think they were, it sounded like a little too much of a games as service and less of like a thing that was like a turnoff for fans, but it doesn't seem like they did a giant pivot into something negative.
Yeah.
You know, it seemed like it was a subtle shift that was just enough for people to go, yeah, we're kind of done with that. And it really made them, I would really wonder with these companies, like how you, I mean, Ubisoft has a giant stable of IP that they could kind of figure out what's working somewhere else and use their IP to kind of
write the ship, all that kind of stuff.
And same thing with EA and same thing with Activision. But to have like a giant success like these other companies just seems really hard, because all of those kind of came from some passion play from a small, lean, nimble group.
Right.
And yeah, I mean,
some visionary, right? You know, somebody that's like, this is my vision, I'm going to push this through. This is not by committee, you know, that kind of.
The one thing that they could do more of, I suppose, would be to buy more indie devs that looked like they're on the cusp of it. You know, if you saw, and that's kind of what Microsoft's been doing, right? Like, enough of like, you know, like Obsidian just, I mean, they clearly saw them doing the Outer Worlds that, you know, Obsidian had a great track record. Always had a problem with funding. Because they're, you know, and then seeing like, oh my God, they're actually making a game now that's like the game people have wanted. And they bought them a year before it even came out. And like, they're going to definitely be rewarded for that play.
Right.
You know, that's going to work out. And I think like, that's probably what, you know, EA or somebody should do is being, it just seems like they've, those companies haven't acquired as much. You know, they've been very top down and maybe they need to, you know, look into that stuff.
Yeah.
I'm always excited as like an indie group where it's like, there's so few mid-sized indies that we're always like, you know, and that, like every time there's like one that, you know, like, damn it, Insomniac's amazing. And then they're like, oh, they got bought. Okay, never mind. They're not, we're not really competing with them. They're owned by Sony. And then like, you know, Obsidian, like, damn, you know, Obsidian's amazing. Like, oh, no, Microsoft bought them.
Microsoft bought them. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like slowly there's not like that many in the mid area, you know, that you feel like you're actually like competing, like, you know, on that kind of scale. With.
Yeah. Got a niche there. What about like AR and VR? Because I know you guys were early on, space in the name, but the VR with the VR experience with Steve Bowler and stuff like that. What are your thoughts on AR and VR?
Yeah, so it's funny. This is the first year in, I think, 4 years that we don't have a VR work for a hire project right now. Like we wrapped something up that I can't talk about, but it may never see the light of day. Like it literally, like they're having a hard time realizing if they should even publish it because, you know, the project was approved, went through like TRC submissions,
oh, cleared wow. everything. That far, right?
Yeah. And they're just more like, we don't know if it's worth the effort to release it because it's just like the market is so strange. Like,
right. And the marketing money they have to put in it and the user acquisition.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like that, the support, the marketing money, keeping, you know, so people don't refund it and what they have to do. And yeah like, do they want to even, you know, it's a famous movie IP and they're like, do we even want to like dilute the movie IP if we need to use it for something else? Like, will they feel like, do we want it to feel more like it's been a while since you saw this IP versus like, you know, having this out and then doing something else in 2 years? So,
right.
It was like this thing where they kind of have viewed to shelf it. And it's just, I think like VR is in a really interesting state where I think for a while I was like, okay, this is, you know, I think like it's super compelling. You know, you have these, but it was hard to set up, you know, you'd have to calibrate your room.
Yeah,
you'd have to
paint in the lighthouses. Ass, very hobbyist.
Yeah, totally. And then I think when like Quest and smaller things came out, it was kind of disappointing to see, well, with even with that friction gone, it's still just not latching the same way. And it's like, I almost feel like what's funny about VR is like whenever I would have it ready and somebody had the mind space for it and I would give it to them, they'd be like, this is amazing. I love this. Mm-hmm. This is so cool. This is totally the future of entertainment.
Yeah.
And then they just wouldn't feel ever compelled to do it on their own. It's almost like
going
to some great restaurant or something and you're like, yeah, I loved it. It was an amazing meal. But I may never go there again for whatever reason, like commitment or getting a babysitter or the time, or it's a far enough drive. There was some reason you just don't do it enough. And I think like that was like kind of, it feels like that's what VR has been like for a lot of people where they like it, but it's like maybe just being turned off to the world for any piece of time is too much for them.
Yeah.
You know, not knowing what's happening on their phone, not knowing what's going on around them, that it's just, you know, I mean, movies are even a little bit like that for me, where sometimes when I go to a movie, I do get a little anxious. I don't know, you know, what's happening. Like if I go on a weekend or something, it's fine. But if I go early during the week, I'm like, is someone trying to get a hold of me? Is something going on? Like it's always a little bit in the back of my head. And I think with VR, that's like an amplification of you don't know what's going on around you.
Right.
I tend to think of like sometimes I even think with VR where, to me, the evolution of VR will really be that where you kind of like lay down in bed and you put maybe two electrodes up to your temples and you know, you get this like flawless reality of like a dream, you know, where you smell things, you feel things, you, you know, it's like, it's the most deep realistic thing as possible. And you can go on a virtual vacation and do everything. And it actually feels like you're doing it.
Right.
And that's something that I feel like, you know, I'm not even sure if that'll happen in my lifetime, but that would be the ultimate, like, I think like anyone would do that. It would almost be like a drug, right? Like,
you'd
be addicted to living this other life where they have a, you know, if it's some kind of, you know, like outcast, like male outcast, he would have this model wife and model life and everything would be flawless. He'd be the superhero in that universe and he would never want to get out of it maybe. But almost like as it is now, it's like, it's, I'm having a bit of a harder time seeing where it really goes. Like what would it take to make it go more mass market?
And
even like throwing out, like everyone's always like, well, when Apple does it, it'll go, and it's like, well, you still have some of those frictions. I mean, maybe you won't. I don't know. Maybe there'll be some killer app for it that is so like it part of more of your life, the same way that, you know, answering a text is, or the way Facebook is. But I mean, the fact that Facebook has this and they still haven't like turned it into, they haven't even, you know, it hasn't even reached its Facebook audience at all is like a weird thing where it's like, you know, maybe it doesn't reach, maybe, maybe it's too much work, you know, to stand. Maybe it's like, it's hard to know like what that would be. Something I could see, like, which would be really cool for PlayStation 5 would be a much more like easily integrated headset where even if you were playing like sit down games, you could kind of use VR for peripheral to like look around. So you had this beautiful,
you know,
4K display around your eyes. So you're just, you know, wherever you look, you're kind of doing the head look. So, and maybe it's less about standing with the Move controllers and things, but more just like, kind of like what I guess Resident Evil did, but that kind of got people sick. So, you know, if they, even at some system level, like motion settings, like if they gave it a little more thought like that, that could be really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more like a enhanced way to play traditional games or something.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of AR is a really interesting thing for me, where I had a spinoff company doing some AR things, and it was really early with Google Tango.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And I had a launch title for that, like a game. And I think like really early on with AR, it's one of those things, like before it existed, it was so compelling in my head. Like you'd be able to see things in the world, and you'd be able to, you know, there'd be little creatures and little things always around you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the first versions of the games we had, like, you know, it was really hard to make them compelling. Like, like one of our games, like it did actually change with AR. Like we really tried to integrate, like, what would be different about this? What are you using in your world to play the game?
Mm-hmm.
'Cause like all those tabletop games were just like, yeah, they're kind of a gimmick, but the game isn't any different. You know, if you're playing an AR game on your table, it's like gimmick, that could just be a free cam in a normal game. It's not really using your world. So we were trying to use the world not so much directly, like a thing would hide behind a sofa or a thing would do things, but the fact that you had to move around your space, and, you know, mm-hmm. if your space was cramped, it would be harder to play because things would chase you and you needed some room. And, you know, where a staircase was, where a door was, where an exit, where it kind of helped you a bit, but it wasn't very, it still didn't really use the space well enough. I mean, mm-hmm. it still was like the easiest to almost stand in the center and just kind of like shoot things before they got close to you.
Right.
And then I think like I was very enamored by the kind of like early promises of HoloLens and Magic Leap, where, you know, visions in your eyes and you would just see these things like they were lifelike. And
yeah.
I mean, I remember it sounding like that sounds incredible and unlike anything I've ever seen. And then, you know, none of those things really happened. And then you're like, you kind of learn when you go a lot deeper and understanding all the issues with that, of like how hard it is to shrink. You know, it's like, it's not just like Murphy's Law with, you know, computers getting better and faster, but it's literally like the laws of optics, which don't change, you know, like how you bend light through, you know, a lens
mm-hmm.
is not like, that's not something that really changes. Like that's, you know, we kind of know how that works, you know, and the fact that most of these, you know, work the same way like Disney's Haunted Mansion works. Like it's a Pepper's Ghost trick of, you know, reflecting something off glass or something. And it's like, you need space for that. And, and all these kind of things where it's like, yeah, there's not a lot of ways this can really be shrunk. And then even further, mm-hmm. like the way you have to like understand your surroundings and, you know, like there would always be this talk of like a, you know, the ghost game where, you know, go upstairs and look into your drawers and, you're supposed to find a note and this note will be glowing in your drawer. And it's like, what kind of like machine learning and AI and scanning and everything has to happen before that would even be possible? You know, to like we can barely, you know, make something sort properly with, you know, like a table.
Right.
Like how are we going to
environment versus walking around? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like all that kind of stuff is so far out. And then some of it too, like I think even imagining it working, it's like it's hard to know if it's totally like, do I even care? Do I want to do it some more? Like one mm-hmm. of the best AR games ever was, it was shipped with the whole HoloLens, where it's this game Fragments, where this murder mystery happens and they kind of like tear, it's kind of like it's in your world, but it's out of your world. Like they spawn a fake world inside your world, and mm-hmm. there'll be things like they actually will hide things behind things. So like there's a clue somewhere in this room. And because you have to scan your room in kind of before you play, something will be like hidden behind your couch. And you're like, oh, that's kind of neat. It's behind your couch. And then these virtual characters, they're like smart enough to sit on your chairs and stuff if there's a chair. And if there's no chair, they'll stand. And I'm like, I thought that was really cool. Like, oh my God, it actually knows to sit in this chair versus standing. And I thought that was really cool.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like as cool as that was, and that was really neat, I don't know if I ever needed to do it more than once. You know, it wasn't the same as like wanting to play.
Yeah,
it wasn't the same as like being addicted to like playing Breath of the Wild or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's like, it wasn't like the escapism I like out of those other games or those other things. Like, you know, and it's almost like, you know, maybe games really are fairly perfect by just sitting down and having a screen and you take in what you want and what you don't want mm-hmm. and you choose. You're not, you know, it never gets, maybe the intensity of VR, you know, or AR is like almost too much. Like maybe...
Right.
It's nice that you're not, maybe it's nice that you have a little screen, you know, and that you have your Coke you're looking at and your drink and your food and your, you know, if there's someone else in the room, maybe like that's the right amount of intensity, you know, and actually to be fully immersed is something we always think about as like a golden standard, like the full immersion, mm-hmm. but maybe it's actually not it's
too much. People, yeah. Yeah. Sensory yeah. overload. You're like, I can't.
Right. Like maybe it's cool for a small thing, but not the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like all those, like every time they like, they put like Skyrim and things in VR and, you know, regardless of people. Yeah. yeah. And people say, oh, the port's good or bad, but it seems like everyone's like, yeah, I want to try it. But they don't really like live in there. They don't keep mm-hmm. coming back to it. They don't. Yeah,
not going to play for 40 hours. Like,
yeah, or 200, you know, like they will on their PC. So it's like, and like, yeah, maybe that's why. Maybe it's like, you know, they just, you want to sit. You want to take it easier. You want to. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. And then AR is a weird, you know, to even further go, like, what are my thoughts on it?
Yeah.
That, you know, just a few years ago, I was so excited that it was this open field of like, you know, no one knows where this is going to go.
Mm-hmm.
Like Apple doesn't own it. Facebook doesn't own it. You know, Microsoft doesn't own it. Like anyone could kind of come in here. Nobody
SDKs,
knows how these things
make it for the different platforms.
Yeah, whatever, yeah. And then now it just kind of all devolved into Snapchat filters and Instagram. Literally, like that's all anyone does with it. Nobody cares if you do something really cool. I mean, I've seen some really neat things with body tracking and cool things. And like, no, all they care about is like a gimmicky thing on your face. Like it's like it quickly became
look,
where
you're
I,
a cat.
I made I made a viral thing with it. I made that aha video.
Oh, it's right. Yeah, the aha video. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and it had millions of views. It went viral. I got contacted by venture capitalists the second that happened. It's funny.
Wow,
I actually
that's big.
I uploaded that video an hour before I got on a plane to Europe for a family vacation. So I uploaded the video, went on the vacation, and when I got off the plane, my thing was insane. Like it was literally like it was one of those stories of like where everything went nuts. Like I had tons of like I had TechCrunch contacted me for a story, The Verge contacted me for a story, and I had to do like a call with them in Europe. And I'm like, it was like, why couldn't I have wrapped this up a week earlier?
You know?
But it was so like, it was exciting. It was like, wow, this is exciting technology. This is so neat. And all that just evaporated into nothing. Mm-hmm. Like it's just Facebook filters now. And
yeah. Tell people real quick, just about the whole aha video, just in case they weren't familiar with
so
with the video.
It was basically, you know, aha had this amazing video in the 80s of where, you know, it's real life people. And then they kind of walk into this rotoscoped hand-drawn world. And at the time it was one of the coolest music like videos ever. And I kind of had a play on words where I'm like, this is, you know, AR's aha moment. And some people gave me shit. Like, you really think you figured out this important thing? And it's like, it's a play on words. There's an aha video.
Yeah.
So this is, but it was basically like doing this filter where the world was like half drawn and half not drawn. It's funny. I use this very specific technique to do it. And I still haven't seen it replicated, which is funny because I still get emails of people going, I haven't seen your app. Where's your app? And I just haven't bothered putting it out. But was able to do like it was able to kind of simulate what was doing in the video where you can see this half world that's half hand drawn and half this world that's still real and moving in and out of that space. But like it really like did it crazy blew up for me in a way that nothing else I've ever done has blown up like that.
Right. Yeah, you're right. And if, I mean, you put it out there before vacation, you're like, I've been working on this. Let's get it out. Like you weren't anticipating that, you know, lightning in a bottle.
I had put out other things and nobody gave a shit. Like I had put out, it's funny. I made this one Star Wars AR thing, like well before, like now there's a lot of Star Wars AR, but this at the time there was nothing. And it's funny. It got a little bit of notice and without mentioning names, somebody who was important at ILM contacted me and they're like, you know, what the fuck are you doing?
It's RIP.
Why do you fucking do this? This is RIP. And it wasn't a guy who owned it. He was an employee there, but he was very upset about it. And he's like, you know, because he saw it on Christmas and somebody congratulated him. They said, hey, we saw that cool thing you did.
Like,
we didn't do anything. And he got really mad. I mean, I literally got this text on Christmas Day. So it was like he was at a Christmas party.
Right.
Like when he like furiously typed it, like, you know.
I'll waste that
and
eggnog, son of a bitch.
Yeah. And the weirdest thing, actually, so this is a famous person. This is a person who has an Oscar, I think.
Yeah.
And I
is he short?
Actually, I can't go in. Yeah. Well, no details. But they I actually bumped into them at a professional function. And they said, you're the guy that did that thing, right? I'm like, yeah.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, was I a dick? You know, and I'm like, you're kind of were.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, yeah, you know, he's like, I It's like we have so much stress, you know, where I don't remember if he left the company at that point.
Okay.
But he's like, you know, we get so much stress about what we can and can't do with these IPs and, you know, you can do so many projects and they don't come to life.
Right.
And then everyone's
random
asking
guy
you,
does this thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Everyone's like, you know, we can't justify certain things with budgets and people get mad at money you did spend that you couldn't do something with. And that, yeah. And then when you just kind of came out with that, I think I just blew up or something. So he didn't quite apologize either, but
right.
he at least gave it some context that I'm like, oh, I can totally see that. I can see like why, you know, you kind of want to, they were really hoping to do a big Star Wars AR reveal. And not that my thing went big at all, but the fact that it did get it got like a VentureBeat story and it got something else.
Yeah.
But I think it got enough stories, not so much to the public, but to some professionals. And like to them, it's like if their bosses saw it, that's like what pissed them off. Like,
right.
You guys are moving so slow that this rando did something with this tech. You know,
what the hell did they beat you to the punch, man?
Yeah,
what the hell?
You're we're now rich. Like, I mean, yeah, now there's like Star Wars Google apps and shit like that than AR
you
know, that use. So now it's like, so it's such a different world already in just a few years.
Well, Disney owns it. So Spaceballs, the lunchbox. There you go.
Yes.
Right. Merchandising. So yeah, you've told a bunch here, but like, is there any kind of like a funny or odd story that you haven't told that you want to talk about the industry that kind of stands out?
You know, it's funny. I thought of one thing and I already forgot about it. And then there's some stories that like, I literally couldn't tell because some people would have lawsuits and stuff.
Yeah, so, right. Yeah.
You know, it's like, I can't even like phrase that around something. You
right.
Know?
Or change their name or,
Yeah. One thing I think is interesting is how something I really liked about Viacom, like my first job, which was funny that you'd think this was the opposite of where we'd be. But at Viacom, like, you know, my immediate boss was a woman. And my project lead was a woman. And then the studio head was a woman. And I remember thinking like, oh, that's cool. That's so cool that, you know, this company's like that. And I've never had that again. I've never I thought like it was very normal to have like a, you know, like I couldn't believe how in hindsight, the first job I had 20 years ago in video games was far more.
Right. Especially like, 20 years ago in video games.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. It was more progressive than what, you know, I've ever had now, like, you know, Midway wasn't like that, you know, and it's crazy that, you know, like, that for what I hoped, I thought the industry was more going that direction and it might be finally now, but it's interesting that it's been taking that long to do stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm reminded of that only because my mind started going to all the opposite experiences at Midway where it's just very boys club.
Yeah.
Know, thing of like weird, like things that definitely, you know, were, you know, would not pass the muster of this current generation of thing, you know?
Yeah. Right.
Like, you know, thinking and it's like, it's, you know, all those kind of like weird stories of things that happened already like, wow, you know, it's actually pretty great how much we progressed, you know, past those things to where it was.
Right. Yeah. And I think sometimes, maybe the content drives some of the environment or whatever. Who knows?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, even that's a funny thing of like, you know, when you think of the classic idea of this like booth babe and it's like the fact that that was like some kind of draw to, you know, E3 thing and that like Midway always had like these cheerleader types and things, you know, like the model wearing the skimpy cheer. And it's like, it's funny to think of how, you know, one way you think like how slow things are moving. Then another way it's like, well, that's pretty obsolete.
Yeah.
Quick, you know, like that, and, you know, relatively speaking, that's pretty obsolete, you know.
Yeah. That was part of E3s at one time and CESs. That was business. It was like, it was kind of weird. And now you look back and you're like, wow, that really was weird. And it's gone. So, yeah.
Yeah.
What about games is there a game you're playing now that you're excited about? Or?
Well, I think some of the stuff in, you know, things like the Death Stranding stuff was kind of cool, like I was mentioning.
Yeah.
Something that blows me away. I don't know if you've seen Untitled Goose Game at all.
No, you know? I see it on Twitter feeds and I was like, what is this goose thing everyone's talking about?
Yeah. I mean, it's not so much that it's like mind-blowing like design, but it's like, it's just beautiful. My son loves it. My daughter loves it. It's got a beautiful piano score. I think it's one of those, like, I know, like, I mean, as a game dev, I'm super jealous of it. It's like very simple. It's almost like GTA, but very like micro detailed instead of macro.
Mm-hmm.
you know, it's like basically poking at a simulation by just doing things. It's basically this goose trolling people. It's harassing people. And it's hilarious and funny because it's a goose and there's no violence.
Right.
And it's very like, there's no reset. There's no dying. There's no like, you just kind of just keep doing stuff till what you want to do happens. And it's like, it's really elegant, like in this everything, like the visuals are elegant. The music's elegant. The design is elegant.
Just very polished.
It resonated with people. Yeah. Like, I mean, we got it on the Switch. It's really good on the platform too, of just being able to, you know, play it, hold, you know, on your TV and talk about what you're doing. And everyone wants to grab the controller. Let me try to like mess with that person, you know? And
yeah,
you could just see it. Like they could make the next like Untitled Goose City or, you know, they could keep like expanding it bigger or different locations or a different animal instead of a goose harassing, like a raccoon harassing people or whatever that next, squirrel, you know, like when a squirrel takes, like they could literally turn it to anything and it would just keep going and being charming and amazing. And it's like almost like such a positive role model of a game too.
Right.
You're just like, it couldn't, you know, while you're actually a troll and an asshole and even a bit of a bully, it's like wholesome by, you know, there's no, you're just a goose. Like how bad can a goose be? You know?
Right.
Yeah. And it's just like the fact that it resonated so well. I mean, it might be one of those things like the next one won't do the same this did, but it's even one of those things where I'm even amazed as a developer where sometimes I think I close down that some ideas aren't valid because they were kind of done before. If you think of you know, there was Goat Simulator before.
I
remember like when Goat Sim came out, and like first of all there was a million copycat apps, but then also like, oh well, this is done, you know, you're this goat and you're messing around and you're playing around, so therefore this genre is done. You need to find the next Goat Simulator. But it's funny that like it's vaguely like that, but it's so different and so micro detailed that it doesn't get into some fake physics ridiculousness. It more gets into like very subtle, like, you know, tripping a kid or pulling something or trying to steal someone's hat, like very detailed kind of things.
Yeah, like that are little things. Yeah.
Yeah. In a way that like, yeah, it's basically GTA, you know, but that really tiny, tiny detail that like, instead of it being about cars and distances, it's about very small items and things like that. So,
Check that out. Didn't they do an online version of the Goat Simulator? Or am I getting my wires
crossed? No, they did like an MMO and they did a lot of stuff.
That's like, all right. So we got to do. We got to do an MMO.
I think what it was is it was a company that literally had an MMO. They made a giant RPG and no one cared.
Yeah.
And then on like a lark, they're like, oh, look at this next game we're going to work on for April Fools. And it was like, they just took like a goat asset and they just took like a city and they just smashed them into stuff. And everyone's like, yeah, we want that. And then they literally took their MMO and swapped it with a goat.
Right. You know? Like, we did all this work and you want the stupid goat thing? What the hell?
Yeah.
It's like, you never know. Well, cool. Is there anything I should have asked you about but didn't?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I think we covered enough. Yeah.
And where can people find you online? You know, website, Twitter, things like that. I'll put it in show notes.
Yeah. I think I don't even know my Twitter name. I think it's just Chipsinani on Twitter, something like that. Chipsinani on LinkedIn, anything like that. Yeah. And then, you know, Phosphor is the main game studio I work with. So,
yeah.
Phosphor Games.
Phosphor Games. Okay. Yeah. I'll put all that in show notes. And, this has been great having you on tonight, Chip. And yeah, hopefully people enjoyed this. So thanks.
Cool. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Game Dev Advice, the Game Developers Podcast. If you found it interesting or helpful, please leave a 5-star review. I'd really appreciate it. And don't forget to subscribe. I have a lot of great episodes coming out. As always, I want to hear from you, the game development community. So give me a call at 224-484-7733 or reach out on the website gamedevadvice.com. I want to know your struggles, your questions, and your ideas. Since the podcast is really about you, the fellow game developer, and our game development community. Thanks and take care.